This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 97-year-old Al Skerritt of Seattle, Washington. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, in addition to photos of Al, you'll find a video from WGN-TV in Chicago. It's a phenomenal piece that details how a book by the youngest son of Robert F. Kennedy eventually led to Al getting to talk to the sailor whose life he saved on the USS Bunker Hill 72 years ago. We'll talk to Al about it in a bit, and I hope to catch up with that man he saved, Norm Lasman, on a future episode of Hometown Heroes. But let's pick it up where we left off. It was May 11th, 1945. The carrier was supporting the invasion of Okinawa, and in the early morning hours, a kamikaze attack claimed the lives of nearly 400 men aboard the Bunker Hill. The first Zero dropped a bomb that crashed through the flight deck and out the side of the ship before exploding in the ocean, and the Japanese pilot then crashed his plane onto the flight deck, smashing into American planes loaded with fuel and ammunition and igniting a fire and a series of explosions. 30 seconds later, another Zero dove at the Bunker Hill, plowing through anti-aircraft fire and dropping a 550-pound bomb before crashing into the deck. The bomb made it down through the deck before exploding in the pilot's ready room, setting off more explosions and just adding to the chaos and the devastation. You heard Al Skerritt describe how he pulled one disoriented sailor from the engine room after hearing loud banging from the other side of the hatch. You heard him say how an officer later stopped him from opening a different hatch because the risk of fire and explosion was too great. Later on, Al would see the pile of bodies stacked against the hatch that he had been ordered not to open. But there was another opportunity to potentially save lives that came Al's way, and this time it nearly cost him his life.
This other officer came down there, and he heard about me getting this one guy out of this here hatch from the engine room. He says, "Al, we're going to go down there." And he says, we put on some oxygen service masks. The canister would generate oxygen for 1 hour. And so this officer and I, we climbed down the hatchway to the engine room. And it was so dark down there with smoke and that, you couldn't even see your hand in front of your face. This officer disappeared. I didn't know where he went. And so I knew I couldn't see anything down there. The smoke was so thick. So I leaned up against the bulkhead and just waited, thinking that he would come back and get me, but he never did. And then I knew my oxygen was running out on my mask. And so I said a prayer. I said, "God, help me." And I only, I took one or maybe two steps. I held my hand out in front of me so I wouldn't bump into anything, but my hand grasped a railing, and I knew it was a ladder. And I looked up and I saw this really bright light way up high. It looked to me like the moon. But anyway, I got on this ladder and I climbed up there. And here there was a sailor holding a battle lantern down, and he bawled me out. He says, "Where the heck have you been? Your officer left a long time ago and he told me for me to stay here until you came up." And I thanked him for that. Then I went up to my locker, opened up my locker, and when I opened up my locker, there was a picture of my 2-year-old son, and I cried. Another sailor walked by, and he saw me crying. And he patted me on the shoulder and he says, "Well, the same thing happened to me. I had people at home, and I cried when I got okay. I knew that I was strong enough and well enough to still do things on the ship. So I went up on the flight deck. They were trying to get a fire out in the forward part of the ship, because night was coming on and they wanted to get that fire out, because that would be like a beacon where the enemy could find us. Here, there was a group of guys, they put on these one-hour masks, and this one guy, his name was Spider. I don't know why I remember that name. But he tried to get the mask on. He said, no, this mask doesn't fit. I can't go in there. And so then the officer, he took the mask, he looked around, and I happened to be standing there, and he pushed the mask to me. He says, you're going in. And so I put on the mask, and I climbed down to the next deck down. They put a lead-in line on my back. Then they gave me an inch and a half fire hose. We were supposed to go back in and put this fire out. And when we got back there, well, the hose was too short, so we came back and they put more line on this hose, another 50 feet. We started to go in again and the lead-in line was too short. So we came back out and then the officer says, no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to go in to the top and go down to get that fire out. And then they found out that this was a electrical panel, a 440 voltage, and if we had put water on it and we were wading in 2 or 3 inches of water, we would have been electrocuted. But that didn't happen.
Well, back to when this started. You said they told you on your headphones what had happened and where the damage was. And I know that's a big ship.
Yes.
But did you feel it when the kamikazes hit?
Oh, sure. The deck was loaded with our airplanes, loaded, and the our planes were loaded with bombs, and it was all ready to go out and strike Okinawa.
So when those kamikazes hit, it started a chain reaction, and this damage was severe. There's fire all over the place. There are explosions, and you're getting a little piece of that picture at a time, I imagine.
Yes, I kind of knew what happened because I told you I had earphones on.
Yeah, but you didn't know that nearly 400 men were going to lose their lives in this and that hundreds more would be wounded.
Well, that's true. I remember going up on the deck, down below, and all these here guys piled on one another when we opened up the hatch, and they were dead. Wanting to find fresh air. Everything I tell you, it has to come maybe a little bit slow, but I want to tell the truth.
Well, I've got a few thoughts here. One, this was a really long day. I mean, if this starts at 3 in the morning and you're still at it, you're fighting the fire at almost dusk. I mean, I bet at the end of that day you had to be just exhausted.
Well, yes, that's true. I was exhausted. And I went around the ship to see what else I could do. This followed this officer. And this one thing that was really kind of bad, I got up to one deck, and there was a leg laying on the deck. This one guy says, oh, that we haven't thrown that overboard. That came from that kamikaze. And he picked up that leg and gave it a heave over the side. Oh, and yes, I forgot. The pilot of the kamikaze, his body was laying there. And this one guy says, oh, look at that ring. And he tried to get the ring off of this here kamikaze. It was a nice-looking ring. And he couldn't get it off, so he chopped the finger off to get the ring. Of course, I thought that was awful. But it was really something. Then they picked up the body and threw the body over the side. It was really, it's kind of hard to understand how people could. Oh, I wanted to tell this. You know, on the ship, I thought everybody on this ship, there was 3,000 men, and I thought every one of them was just a wonderful person. But I found out that there was a lot of them that were bad. They went around and they took off watches or anything of value. They'd taken off the dead men for themselves.
And these are the dead Americans, almost 400 of them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that really bothered me. I thought that every guy was a good guy, but that many men, 3,000, there's bad men there too.
Well, I'm sure you saw a lot of things that day that nothing could have prepared you for or that you never wanted to see. And when 390 guys are killed, I imagine there had to be some of those who were guys you knew, guys you'd served with, guys you're around.
There was two of my real good friends that we used to talk at nighttime. Our bunks were together, and so we'd visit back and forth. We'd talk about our hometown and the people in it. And these three guys, there was one guy that him and I him and I was good friends. He had two children and I had one. And so anyway, we found him in the men's bathroom where he had taken off all the seats. There was a big trough. Men would just sit on these seats, and we never had any partition between us or anything. And this trough would take everything out and empty it into the sea. And this one guy that had two children, he took off all the seats, and he laid down in this trough and put his mouth at the outlet trying to get oxygen so he could live, and that's where we found him dead. Then my other two friends, we found them, they were sitting with their legs pulled up close to them and their arms were around their legs, and they were dead, leaning up against the bulkhead there. So I did lose three of my special friends.
And when you see that, and I know, I mean, it's 72 years later now, but even just the thought for you still brings those emotions back like you felt them 72 years ago. As you process through all of that, as you grieve their loss, does there come a point where you also say, that could have been me?
No, I never felt that. I always felt, I guess I just felt like God had me on a mission. And when that mission was over, well, then that would be it. Even now I wonder, 97 years old, and I still wonder if there's a mission.
Well, I think the last year is pretty good evidence that there is. What about after all that? The next day, the days that followed, what did you have to do to clean up the ship, to repair the ship, to honor those who died?
The next day, we had a funeral. They would take four sailors at a time, or sometimes more, and they'd get them ready for burial at sea. And the one thing that they did, they would put a 5-inch cannon shell between their legs to give them weight, and then they would wrap them all up and place them on a stretcher, and they would take them. We had three ministers of different denominations, and they would all give a prayer, and they would drop all these dead sailors overboard with a cannon shell between their legs, but they wanted them to sink to the bottom of the sea.
So when you're on the deck, and you're watching that, and you're seeing guys just like you be buried at sea, and you hear that bugler playing taps, and the ministers saying what they're saying, what kind of things go through your mind?
Well, I was so busy doing things, I didn't want to spend my time there, but I saw some of it. Actually, I had jobs to do, and I wanted my ship to be safe. So I saw them do a couple of burials, and they had these three ministers who said a prayer for every group of sailors that they buried at sea. Well, that reminds me of all the airplanes on the deck that didn't burn. And I don't know how, there wasn't too many of them. They cleaned the deck off of everything. They pushed all the ships, all the airplanes, even if they looked good, we pushed them overboard, and we wanted to clean up the whole area and get rid of all the things that could be dangerous. Anything that burned went overboard. But it still looked very bad when you looked at the area, you saw all the smoky equipment and the damage that had been done with the deck where the bombs hit. Well, the deck was pointing to the sky.
And numbers-wise, only the kamikaze attack on the Franklin claimed more lives than this one on the Bunker Hill. Did they give you guys some survivor's leave after that? Or what happened to you guys? Where'd you go from Okinawa?
We went to Pearl Harbor. We had to get some of the things on the ship in ship shape so we could take it back to Bremerton. Oh, the really a special thing happened when we was pulling into Pearl Harbor. We saw a couple of hundred sailors lined up. Yeah, they were all saluting us as we pulled into Pearl Harbor. It was really quite a sight to see all these sailors side by side lined up, and there was an awful lot of them, and they were all saluting. So they gave us respect.
And it's easy to hear how much that still means all these years later. Break time again. When we come back, Al explains what it was like to see his wife and son again, and the incredible phone call he received just in the last year that answered the biggest lingering question from his heroics aboard the Bunker Hill. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.